Hot Flashes and Cold Topics, a podcast for women in midlife and beyond. At Hot Flashes and Cold Topics, we talk about anything and everything to do with midlife. My name is Bridget.
And I'm Colleen.
And today we are really thrilled to have Dr. Lisa Larkin on. And Dr. Larkin is the founder and CEO of Ms. Medicine, which is a concierge service of all kinds of medical, just across the gamut, medical needs for women. And it's really great. They do cater to women. She still sees men in her practice, but this particular thing caters to women just in all aspects of your health. In a primary care physician, in taking care of your sexual health, women's sexual health, talking about your risk of breast cancer. She is a breast cancer survivor, so you will hear all about that in this interview. And boy, oh boy, the universe was talking to me today because we've talked a lot about pellets. And for the past 2 weeks, we have interviewed guests that have really brought pellets to light.
Universe is sending you a signal.
Universe,
Bridget,
is telling me a big signal and a big message. And I really appreciate being informed by these women that are getting out there and being advocates for other women about taking control of our health and really encouraging you to ask questions. So I'm very excited that we had this talk with her.
Yeah. We just had so much. I mean, we started off the conversation. The primary intent of this episode was heart health, women's heart health over 50. And Dr. Larkin just had so many great pieces of information on your concerns, on your cardiac health, on what you should be looking for. And then the conversation kind of morphed into, she is a certified medical expert at the North American Menopause Society, which she speaks very highly of. She's been involved in the organization for 25 years. And we kind of pivoted into a conversation on healthcare in general and what healthcare should look like for women and what it actually looks like in reality and how far we need to go, how big the difference is between that and how she's trying to help in her own small way to educate primary care physicians for women's health. And then we morphed again into talking about hormone replacement therapy, which brought up Bridget's pellets in her tushy and how she did them once, but she's not going to do them
again. I don't think I'm
going
to do them again. No, I talked to her too, as well as how I thought it would be easier, make my life easier. Well, it's really not making my life easier. I mean, I said, I have to go in, get a little cut in my butt and have wait to swim and have, those little bandages on and avoid that little spot in the shower. And I'm like, that's not making my life easier. I am all about making life easier in a safe manner.
And, exactly.
Yeah. And right now, just from what I'm hearing for me, it's just not,
it's not making it safer.
It's not making it safer. It's not making it easier. So I'm going to go back to what I was doing because I was doing okay. I was doing all right. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Better to be safe. And yes. So she talks all about how, hormonal replacement therapy gets a bad rap from the reports done in the early 2000s. So she speaks about those and then relates them to bioidentical hormones. And it's a really interesting conversation. And after about an hour, we realized we needed her to come back on because we hadn't even merged into the breast risk assessment, sexual medicine, and all the other. I mean, Dr. Larkin is Yale educated, University of Chicago educated. She's been in practice for 30 years. She knows her stuff, and I probably could have kept her on here for another
three hours, sure.
Right?
Yeah, I'm sure I could have.
Bridget and I were like, will you come back? So we're going to let her get started because really it's an amazing conversation and something that you need to hear. She talks about the realities of healthcare that we know about, but we don't like to look at. And we need to take a look at that in order to change it. So we will get started with Dr. Larkin, and we will talk to you after the episode. Welcome back to Hot Flashes and Cool Topics, guys. Today we have on a really special guest, Dr. Lisa Larkin, and she is not only a board member of the North American Menopause Society, she is a physician, an expert in women's health, and we have a couple of topics that we want to talk about today, but welcome, Dr. Larkin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we are. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us and our listeners about all things related to women's health, because there are a lot of topics that women just feel are not being addressed. And so we kind of wanted to start today talking about women's health when it comes to cardiovascular health. And I guess my first question is, what are some of the concerns women have once they reach 50 about heart health?
All right. So this is really an important topic for women. And let me start by saying that, you know, women really typically focus on their breast cancer risk. And, you know, that's what we all are aware of. I'm a breast cancer survivor myself, but I'm an internist. And, you know, I take care of women as they age. And cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death of women, not breast cancer. And I do a lot of modeling for my patients when they're in the office about what their 10-year risk of developing breast cancer is and their lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. And I compare that to what their risk is of developing cardiovascular disease, because that's really often a very important thing that they don't realize, right? So, you know, they really want to worry about breast cancer when in fact many women have very substantial cardiovascular risks and they're unaware of it. What we know now with women and heart disease is that, you know, heart disease is completely different. It's a different disease in women than it is in men, right? So no surprise, you know, we are different. It's not just our reproductive organs that make us different than men, but we are different down to every single cell in our body, right? Our DNA fundamentally is very different, and our cells have been in an environment of a completely different hormonal state for our entire life. So no surprise that diseases that present in both men and women are different in women. And for years now, because of lack of research in women and the way that we've just had this lens, we have treated women like smaller men when it comes to cardiovascular disease. And they're not. Women's heart disease is completely different. Women have smaller coronary arteries. They form plaque completely differently in their arteries than men do. So men typically form bulk plaque, and then they have, you know, that crushing chest pain. Women tend to have much more diffuse plaque that forms in their coronary arteries, and so their symptoms tend to be more mild or different. They don't have that elephant sitting on their chest symptoms. They often will note fatigue or a little bit of indigestion at times, or a little bit of arm or shoulder pain. It can be very what we call atypical. I hate to use that word because women are 50% of the population. And how is the leading cause of death in women? How is their symptoms atypical? But it's different than the classic way that we were taught in medical school that we think of heart disease, right? So we know that women, you know, go undiagnosed longer than men. We know that they're treated less aggressively. We know that they're more likely to be sent out of the emergency room with a heart issue that was not correctly diagnosed. We just have a whole lot of education to do for women and clinicians to make them much more aware of cardiovascular disease, for sure. So that's a long answer to say this is a really, really important topic to talk about today.
So what are some things that if a patient's coming to see you that's about my age, 53 years old, that you would maybe do to check and see that how their heart health is going?
Right. So that's a great question. And let me again just kind of set the stage of what happens at midlife, right? So I talk to women all the time about this, right? Which is men age differently than women. And menopause and the loss of ovarian function and change in hormone levels has a whole lot of consequences for women. And women age, frankly, pretty abruptly right around that time. All kinds of physiologic things happen. Some of the most important thing that happens is that we have increased cardiovascular risk very quickly for women, right? So lots of things happen. Blood pressure goes up. We have change in cholesterol. LDL, total cholesterol, goes up. We have change in the way that fat is distributed. So women start to have abdominal fat. We know that they get increased fat around their heart. All of these things, insulin resistance and prediabetes often develops. All of these things taken together, it's a time when women go from being young and reproductive reproductive age and not really worrying about very many things. And suddenly they're menopausal and now their cardiovascular risk factors go up. And so 50 and menopause is a time where I'm really, really focused on identifying factors that women have that put them at high risk. So certainly all the things that everyone thinks about. So smoking, high cholesterol, blood pressure, diabetes, and family history. Those are really, really important. Making sure that women's are exercising and are really watching, you know, their diet. I talk all the time now about helping women move to more of a plant-based diet with less animal protein. But lifestyle really matters when it comes to cardiovascular disease. But then all the things. I mean, I really look at them for their blood pressure and lipids and whether or not they have any borderline blood sugars and talk to them about the weight gain, because we can, using all of these factors, kind of have a sense of what their 10-year and lifetime risk of cardiovascular disease is. And we work really hard to help them with lifestyle measures to and medications when appropriate to lower cardiovascular risk.
So what would be, let's talk about family history. For example, my father died from heart disease and his brother died from heart disease and not the healthiest side of the family. As a woman who's 53, if I came in relatively good health, how much of a factor would that play into my...
So it definitely plays a factor for sure. So typically when we think about heart disease in women versus men, again, because estrogen is really protective in women, women tend to be 10 years behind men, but that doesn't mean your risk is low. So we definitely take your family history and the male relatives in your family having early heart disease. That is definitely a risk factor for you as well. And we would take that into consideration of how aggressive we want to be. Now, for you, what women don't often realizes, you know, I will be seeing patients when they're in their 30s and 40s and their lipids are normal, cholesterol is normal, and, you know, they they're thin and they're active and they feel fine and their blood pressure is low. And then really they come to see me at 52 and 53 and now they're menopausal. And all of a sudden I say, you know, your cholesterol is high. And they say, no, it's not. That's wrong. You know, my cholesterol's never been high. Well, you know, your blood pressure is a little bit high today too. That's just not right. I've never had high blood pressure before. And it's all of these things that start to happen. So if it was you, for example, and your cholesterol is now elevated and your blood pressure now is a little bit high and you have this family history, and when we can calculate what we call your ASCVD risk score, it's actually borderline. In some patients now, I'm doing what's called a coronary calcium score to actually do a test to see if you are forming plaque or have the earliest changes in your coronary vessels to suggest that you're forming plaque more than I would expect for someone at your age, right? Because genetics play into this as well. And so if, for example, you at 53 have risk factors, family history, your blood pressure is a little bit borderline now, and your cholesterol is a little bit high, and I do this coronary calcium score test, and it looks like you are starting to be on this path of forming plaque, that makes me be much more aggressive with you in terms of what I'm kind of doing. And often it's a very helpful data point for patients to say, oh my gosh, this really is real. I really am aging and I need to be very aggressive with this because, again, heart disease is the leading cause of death of women. And the good news is if we identify people at risk, there's lots of things that we can do.
So how would you do that test?
Oh, so that's an easy test. That's done in the radiology department of most health systems now. It's inexpensive. It's a low radiation dose test. In my community in Cincinnati, it costs $100. Doesn't matter where I send you to do it. It's not covered by insurance. But it's a very helpful test for me in the right patient sometimes I'll use it as well when patients have a high cholesterol and they are at risk of heart disease and they have fear of taking cholesterol-lowering medications and they really don't want to take their blood pressure medications and they don't believe that they have to worry about this. And then the test can be a helpful data point to say, you know, really, you need to take this much more seriously than you're taking it. And sometimes I can use it to convince them to take medications and do more with lifestyle, frankly. You know, making lifestyle changes for all of us is very hard, but when it comes to heart disease prevention, it's absolutely critical.
That's so interesting because I did take that test. I think because of my family history, it's so simple. You literally, I think it's $75 where we are in Nashville.
And you go in. A cheaper test.
Yeah, it was worth every penny. And I actually had a zero score, which means I had.
Oh, that's great, Colleen.
But what is the score that you would worry about? Because it's based on zero to whatever.
Right.
If you did take that score, what's something for a woman over 50 what's a number that's concerning?
So this is, it's a hard question to answer because it depends on your gender and it also depends on your age. So the way that the test is scored is a zero is a zero, right? So that's a good score. But what you would see on your report, and I don't know if you actually saw your report, but it will tell you that for a woman based at your age, 52 or 53, when you had it done, you are in the 0 to 25 percentile, 25 to 50, they put you into a quartile to tell you how your risk is compared to others. And so, you know, a score of 30 in a 53-year-old is not the same as a score of 30 in a 70-year-old, right? So it's hard for me to answer that question.
Okay.
In terms of the magnitude of the risk. But in general, you want your score to be zero. I mean, zero is zero, and a score of zero gives you a pretty, you know, not 100%, nothing's 100% in medicine, but tells you that you have a very low risk of heart disease for the next 10 years. The nuclear stress tester, you know, where people get on the treadmill, that is a very important test. It's not the same as the coronary calcium score, though, either. And the reason, and I think it was the right test for you to have, Colleen, because you're young, right? So what the stress tests do is identify significant plaque, right? So the stress test only is abnormal when you've got enough plaque in those coronary arteries that your blood is obstructing. What we really want to know in younger women is, are you starting to have any of the changes in the vessels, the very beginning changes to tell us that your vessels are starting to get old, but you're not at the point where you have this extensive plaque, you know, that a big bulky plaque or plaque that's going to cause blockages. And so the coronary calcium score is a really helpful test in someone with risk factors who's in their early 50s or close to 60.
And I think one of the things to realize is that there are so many things out there we can do now to be aware of our risk factors and to minimize that risk, that women have to really advocate for themselves when they go into a doctor's office. Do you still find women who come in there in their 50s and 60s having trouble advocating for their own health?
So absolutely, unfortunately. And, you know, helping women have improved health literacy so they can be better advocates for themselves is one of my missions in my last segment of my career. I say that I'm on the back nine now, and it's part of why I founded Ms. Medicine and why I founded Ms. Med Ed is really about empowering women to be able to be better advocates for themselves. Because although the World Wide Web and being able to, you know, Google anything now is really, really positive in a lot of ways, there's also some negatives with it as well, because it's very difficult to sort out fact from fiction or what's good advice versus bad advice on the internet. And so, you know, you really do need some degree of health literacy and to be able to ask the right questions of your clinician when you see them. Because the value of having a connected relationship with your physician as we all age is really, really important. I have two young adult children, one who's a physician, 28-year-old, who's graduated from medical school during COVID and is doing her internship now, and a 25-year-old son. But my son, for example, you know, just thinks that having your doctor on your phone through these app platforms is like the greatest thing going, right? Because he really likes his like virtual doctor who he's never met, who plays tennis like he plays tennis, and who can give him a prescription for a sinus infection. But, you know, to your point, you know, you really need a partner, because as we age, health issues become more complicated, and you really need to have someone that knows you well. At 25, you know, if you're healthy, that's much less important, right? Because the little stuff you can just manage. But for all of these specific discussions, you're 100% correct.
the taboo subjects of menopause and heart health and all that, they need to be broken through, because you can survive if you are caught, things are caught early, like your breast cancer risks that you talk about, and your heart health and menopause symptoms. It's such an overwhelming task. How do you, you created Miss Medicine, which I definitely want to talk about, but was that in response to all these topics that just seemed overwhelming for a lot of women?
Absolutely. I mean, I can tell you, so Ms. Medicine, the mission of the company that I founded that I'm working very hard on is really to, you know, it's simple, is to elevate the care of women and to really, again, help change the narrative that women's health is not just reproductive health, right? Women's health is not contraception and getting your pap smears and having babies. And I love my OBGYN colleagues and I need them, and they are a critical piece of women's health, but women's health extends beyond that, right? And you really, in the primary care world, we really haven't done a good job of educating primary care clinicians, frankly, on gender-specific needs of women. And in today's world, and I've been practicing in the women's health space for 30 years now, it really hasn't changed very much. It's really not that much better than it was, even with some incredible advances and really better understanding. Women are still just lumped together largely as, you know, smaller men. And in the primary care setting, so when women transition for all the reasons that we've talked about, right, because heart disease risk develops and they get hypertension and now they have, you know, bad asthma and, you know, they develop joint disease or they develop lupus or, you know, all of the other things that I treat as an internist, right? They're not seeing their GYN as much anymore, right? And now they're in the primary care setting getting their care. And the problem is nobody's looking at them through the lens of women's specific care, right? So even in the heart disease arena, as I said, women's heart disease is different than men. The cholesterol medication data is different in women than it is in men. Aspirin data in women is different than it is in men. There's all kinds of things that we should be looking at differently in women than men that's just getting neglected. And so Ms. Medicine was really founded after 30 years of really seeing these gaps in care for women and really wanting to try to make an impact in the last 10 years of my professional career, to really change the narrative and to get women being able to better advocate for themselves through education, and then also to educate primary care clinicians on these in very important areas that are just being missed. And primary care doctors really want to do a good job. They haven't been well educated in the women's health space. And so I'm all about innovation and care delivery models, which is my concierge medicine piece, but then really educating women and educating clinicians in areas where we know women aren't getting enough care or the correct care.
You are a certified menopause clinician. How does one go about receiving that certification?
Right. So I will tell you, I am, as you mentioned, on the board of the North American Menopause Society, which I will give a huge shout out to, is my professional home, is the organization that I have, you know, I've been involved with for 25 years. That is how I got involved in the menopause space and how I really did the extra training and the CME and the certification and sat for the exam. Again, I got to NAMS because of being, you know, new in practice after finishing residency and very early in the early 1990s already seeing, oh my gosh, women, menopause is just, I mean, no one was talking about menopause. And I was a young female physician. I had all these female patients. And I'm like, these women are getting really, no one's doing this. And then the sexual medicine piece was very, very clear that that was being neglected. And so got involved in NAMS very early. And Dr. Wolf Udian, who founded NAMS, who now is emeritus from the organization, but someone that I know quite well, and he's, you know, been a mentor and just inspirational all of these years. But the organization is incredible. And so for me, I'm out there again with Ms. Med Ed really saying we need to do a better job educating primary care providers. I want to get primary care providers to come to NAMS and really do the certification and really be really involved in this organization, because it's a multidisciplinary organization. And one of the things that you know, I would tell you, so I'm very involved in my internal medicine organization. I'm a member of ACOG, which is the big OBGYN organization. Those really still are kind of siloed, right? What NAMS is really this incredible organization that brings all of these specialties together and is really the place where, again, it's my professional home. The problem that I see, though, is, you know, primary care providers are so busy, and it's hard to be a primary care provider right now. I mean, the pace at which, and the reason that I left an academic job and am now in private practice is because I couldn't see 26 or 28 patients a day and do high quality medicine. I couldn't do it. And I didn't want to do it anymore because I didn't think I was serving my patients well. And so really left to kind of do things differently. But the majority of primary care providers are employed and they are really busy and they're never going to take 4 days to come to a NAMS meeting or sit for a certification exam, which is what Ms. Med Ed for me is all about, is I want to try to take it to them in a way that they can get at least pieces of education again. So, because doctors want to do a good job for their patients, for sure. Our mission is all the same. It's just the practice environment doesn't really support women's health, and the fact that they haven't gotten enough education doesn't help either, right? Particularly in all of these arenas that you mentioned, right? So breast cancer risk assessment, so menopause, women and heart disease, sexual medicine, bone health, cancer survivorship. I mean, that's another area I could go on and on and on about how, you know, we have millions, it's 3.6 million breast cancer survivors now in the United States, right? And I can tell you, the majority of them are not getting adequate survivorship care. Things are being just missed across the board because no one takes an interest in it, right? It's just, and women don't advocate for themselves enough.
Can you talk a little bit about the concierge service and how that came about?
Yeah. And so, and what I was going to say is another piece that will change in my children's lifetime. I don't know if I'll be alive to see it, but you know, I mean, we have problems with our healthcare delivery in the United States. And I think this COVID pandemic and the rollout of testing and the rollout of vaccines and what kind of happened, if that hasn't taught all Americans that we have real fundamental problems in healthcare delivery in our country and how we pay for it and how we get things done, I don't know what will. But I will tell you, the big reason that I am practicing in a concierge medicine model or direct primary care model outside of insurance right now is really what I came to when I left in 2016, when I left my academic position, of really saying practicing high quality women's health in an employed position where it's RVU targets and it's how many patients can I see in an hour and in a day. That is not good for patients, and it's not good for doctors either, which is, you know, the burnout rate among primary care providers now is huge. And with COVID, you probably know, lots of primary care providers said, I can't stay in business, you know, the independent ones, this is like, it just doesn't work. And so the problem is, until, in my opinion, as much as, and I am a strong believer that every American should have access to high quality care. And I want that for all Americans. What I realized was I can't fix the system from within the system. And so I am going to step out and in my own little microcosm, have a practice that I can take care of my own little panel of patients. It's not going to change the world, but I'm going to do it for those patients in a way that is high quality care, because that's what I believe in. And then Ms. Medicine is my way of trying to scale that to everyone, because I believe everyone should have access to outstanding care. We're an affluent country. The problem is the existing models does not support it. And I'll give you an example, which is the way that it's not just that primary care providers, the targets are so high now, 26, 28 patients a day. I'm sure you realize that the nurse practitioners and what we call the mid-level providers or the advanced practice nurses, and I employ two of them in my practice, and so I'm not anti-nurse practitioners. That's not the message of this at all. But the fact of the matter is their training is different than me, right? And what's happened within these employed models now is, and with reimbursement, is that we're just like widgets in primary care, right? Jane Smith nurse practitioner is equivalent to Lisa Larkin in terms internal medicine doctor, and basically we have to see the same number of patients and we have to earn our keep with seeing patients, right? That's the way that it works. And so the model for primary care is terrible. Whereas think about cardiology, GI, orthopedic surgery, right? The payment is by doing things to patients. It's by doing cardiac caths. It's doing colonoscopies. It's doing joint replacements. Again, it's volume driven, but you get incentivized for doing things to patients, right? Who really wants to sit down and talk to women about sexual health when it takes 30 minutes to even scratch the surface, or talk the pros and cons about hormone therapy, which takes at least 30 minutes, or you really want to sit down and do modeling for a patient about their breast cancer risk and whether or not they need enhanced screening with a breast MRI, or whether or not we should talk about the pros and cons of taking medication to lower their risk, or how about talking about diet and breast cancer prevention? There is absolutely no financial incentive to any primary care provider for doing any of those things. And when you're in an employed model and you're getting thrashed to see 26 or 28 patients a day, and the only thing that they care about is that you close your charts in Epic and sign them and you've clicked your boxes correctly, like, the care just doesn't get done. And so the concierge medicine model came about for me as a way to really say, I'm going to take care of my panel of patients differently and better. And it doesn't fix the problem for our country. And I want to fix the problem for our country, but I have to at least take control of my own patient panel. And so then Ms. Medicine, the company now, so I have my practice, and then Ms. Medicine has really three pillars. It has developing a network across the U.S. of high-quality primary care providers who have a specialty in women's health. And so you may have heard of a concierge medicine company called MDVIP. They're the largest concierge medicine company in the country. They have about 1,000 internists networked across the U.S. I want to do something, it's what I'm trying to do is something similar. Our models are a little bit differently, but to really focus on gender-specific concierge care. This is high-quality primary care, women's health across the lifespan, really with a focus on women. Now, I still do take care of men. I have patients that have been with, male patients who've been with me for almost 30 years, and I still really like to take care of men, but this is really about elevating the care of women. So that's pillar number one. Pillar number two is forming a larger network of, they don't have to be practicing concierge medicine, but really identifying the outstanding women's health clinicians across the U.S. in varying specialties and networking them, so that ultimately my goal is to have a resource for consumers to say, in my area, I can find these five women's health clinicians and kind of have a resource. So that's number two. And number three is the education arm that I've talked about. So I'm really all about educating and empowering women with questions to ask, higher health literacy, going in and saying, listen, my mother had breast cancer, and I hear that there's something about breast density that matters, but I don't really understand it. And can you tell me, like, should I be doing something to lower my breast cancer risk? And like forcing the clinician to say, gosh, we should think about this, because truthfully, the way that we're approaching breast cancer is completely terrible, right? We just tell women to get their mammogram. We never talk about prevention for breast cancer or what they should be doing, right? So trying to educate women, they need to ask more questions. That's the consumer side. And then it's really all about trying to take women's health education to the primary care providers who are in practice in a way that they can get it. The world of healthcare has changed in the 30 years since I've been practicing, and it is really hard to be a good internist right now. And it is really hard. And yeah, the system does not support high quality primary care. It just doesn't.
There are so many layers to that that would need to be unfolded that we would need like 3 hours.
I know, as you can tell. Yeah. I talk.
No, and I absolutely think it's imperative to give women options and to understand that there are resources out there to educate yourself to become your own best advocate, because you're going to have to be. I mean, we have all had the experience where you go to your primary care physician, whoever they assign you, and they're spending 15 minutes with you, and 90% of that time is not even looking at you, but typing into their laptop all of the symptoms you're talking about, and you may feel overwhelmed, you may forget something. To be able to just sit with someone and talk for 30 minutes, it's it's number one, an anomaly. I don't think it happens too often anymore. But two, you don't think of the opposite perspective, which is the doctor who's trying to see all these patients and give quality care, but can only be spread so thin in a day.
No, I have to tell you, that's right. And I know from the patient's perspective, paying for your doctor, you pay lots of money for help, for expensive health insurance. You've got a copay. You schedule your appointment. You show up. You really want that doctor's time. And I promise you, doctors, if you make it through medical school and residency and you've been practicing, we, our heart is in the right place and we have worked hard to get the education where we are. Like, doctors want to do a good job. You know, it really is hard to be a primary care doctor in these settings right now. And from the patient perspective, I completely understand it's why you're mad, why patients would be mad. But when you look at it from our perspective as the clinician, like, I just got to tell you, it's hard. And it is the reason that I said, I am not going to practice medicine this way for the last 10 years of my career.
Another point that I want to talk about, and that I know you want to bring up as well, is the role of hormone replacement. Yeah. and how sometimes it's gotten a bad rap and the different types. So, and we talked earlier before we started recording about pellets, and I really, because I had pellets, and I really do feel like maybe I was rushed a little bit with that information. And since I had my first pellets inserted, I'm finding out other things, not only from you, but from other people. So I really would love to share all of that, because I think that the more we know, the more we can figure out what we really want for ourselves.
Well, I can just tell you that you should have me back to do a whole hour, because what do I have? I have 10
okay.
minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. You think I get passionate talking about what I just talked about, you should get me going on all hormone stuff. Well, so I would start by saying, first of all, I know you got a pellet in. One pellet has not done you any harm. And I understand what's happening and why people get to the point of having pellets. And I have both in my practice, a primary care practice, but I also do consultative women's health. And so I get a lot of women who have been getting pellets and, you know, then want a second opinion because the pellets have been costly, or they're starting to have side effects, or they've read something that they're worried about and they come to talk to me. So I have a lot of experience with women just like you, and I understand how you get there. So again, I in no way want to be totally negative about the fact that you've got one, but I'll really set the stage for the listeners by saying, first of all, hormones are not all bad. And, you know, despite what remains on the package label of all hormone therapy now, that label that says that it increases breast cancer and heart disease and stroke and dementia really comes from the Women's Health Initiative data. And the package insert and that labeling does not really apply to all women in the way that it's written. Right now, I know that we're not going to change that package label anytime soon, because the Women's Health Initiative data will, you know, we will never have another study of that size, I don't think ever, because it was very costly. But we've come a long way in our understanding of hormone therapy. I would like to say we were completely positive when I first started practicing in the 1990s, and I had every single one of my patients on hormone therapy at that point, because we believed we were preventing cardiovascular disease in all women. So all of my diabetic hypertensive patients were on hormones, and that was wrong. And then we had the Women's Health Initiative data, and we went all the way 180 degrees the other way. And then hormones became horrible, and everybody stopped taking hormones 100%. And all of my primary care provider colleagues, internist colleagues, said, "Oh my God, we've been wrong. Hormones are horrible. I'm never prescribing hormones again." And I will tell you, from 2002 to right now, even though we understand the data completely differently, I'm on all these professional meetings with my other colleagues. Primary care providers do not know anything about the hormone data at all. And it's easier, frankly, to just say to women, your hot flashes are going to go away. Hormones are bad. It causes breast cancer and heart disease. And you should go take some supplements and forget it. And that is completely not evidence-based at this point. So we went all the way negative. And now the good news is, and, you know, I know some of the other people that you know and my colleagues and friends who you've interviewed as well, you know, we've come really back to the middle. And we have a really good understanding now about who hormones really have benefit, much higher benefit than risk, and in which patients really have more risk than benefit. And so this is part of what takes 30 minutes, at least 30 minutes. And really, I spend an hour with my women's health consults. This is really doing individualized care where I really need to know everything about you, right? I need to know about your family history of heart disease. I need to really understand your family history of breast cancer. I really need to understand how old you are, when you went through menopause, what your lipids are, what your blood pressure is. We really need to have a very clear, thoughtful conversation and discussion about what the data shows, and then make a decision through something we call shared decision-making about hormone therapy. And the truth is, for the vast majority of young menopausal women, and so that means average age of menopause in the U.S. is 51, I'm saying women within 10 years of menopause, right? But so, you know, I'm talking you both, right? We're talking the 49 to 55-year-old woman who comes to see me with terrible hot flashes and vaginal dryness and sleep disturbance and palpitations and anxiety, and I know she's losing bone, and she's miserable. She is... most of the time, again, there's caveats to everything, right? This is what it takes, some investigation. In her, in general, hormones are beneficial. They help bone, brain, and heart, and they help sexual function, and they improve sleep, and they can have a positive impact on mood, and estrogen is positive. Now, again, it's for symptomatic women, and these are younger women. That is a completely different animal than if I have a 78-year-old woman who's on medication for hypertension, who comes in, who has absolutely no menopause symptoms. She had menopause 28 years ago. Hormone therapy is not safe in her. The risk of hormone therapy in her is higher than the benefit. We would not give her hormone therapy, right? And so it's really trying to understand the right patient to use hormone therapy in, right? And you two, based on your age, I know nothing about your family history, of course, enough to really make that statement. But in general, if you're having hot flashes and night sweats and you're a healthy 52-year-old, you're probably, again, I say this, right? You know,
right.
Cancer survivors, right. Not if you've had a prior TIA or stroke, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of things that I would say no to. But in general, hormone therapy is beneficial for you and you should take hormone therapy. And again, we can talk about what kind of hormone therapy and if we give it across the skin or we give it orally and dosing and all of that kind of stuff. Now, back to the pellets, because I'll, in the last couple minutes, just say something about that. So here's the story with pellets. Pellets have been lumped into this terminology called bioidentical hormone therapy, okay? Bioidentical hormone therapy is different than pellets, but the language in the public space has become very confused. When I prescribe hormone therapy for my patients, 99% of the time, I am giving you FDA-approved bioidentical hormones. Bioidentical meaning the type of hormones that your body made when you were reproductive age, estradiol and progesterone. And sometimes, depending on the situation, a small amount of low-dose testosterone. Okay, right? Those are the hormones that I will prescribe, and those are bioidentical. The pellets are also bioidentical. They're using estradiol and testosterone and progesterone, and that is bioidentical. But the difference is these are compounded pellets. They are not FDA approved. They're made in a lab, in a local lab. They're compounded according to a doctor's prescription in terms of the amount of the products that are put in it, and they're put into your butt. You know, they're pellets. Now, the problem with them is that one pellet to another, you may get varying doses. In my opinion, these hormone centers, some of the big problems are they don't do adequate informed consent about what they're giving. And when patients get pellets, unlike any time I give you a hormone product that you go to the pharmacy to get, you get a package insert. So you get that information that has that box warning. It says something to you. You are getting some information about that. When you get a pellet, you get absolutely nothing. The other problem is a lot of times at these hormone centers where these pellets are being done, women are never even examined. I cannot tell you the number of times that I have had women come in and who have a skin condition on their vulva called lichen sclerosis, and they've been getting pellets because no one's actually examined them, right? So that's number one. The second thing that happens with the pellets is patients will start to get vaginal bleeding sometimes. And the hormone centers, they don't examine you and they don't deal with vaginal bleeding. They send you to me, right? So the people who are prescribing all the meds don't actually manage the complications. The biggest thing though, and this is what I would say, is that the dosing is wrong. Okay. So a little bit of estrogen that we can talk about may be right for you, good for heart, brain, bone, and sexual function. The dosing of these pellets are high. I can tell you in the women that come to see me, I have seen testosterone levels way above the male range. Not just so in my lab, women are 0 to 50, reproductive age women and menopausal women, the testosterone level. Men typically are 300 to 900. I can't even count the number of women that I've had come in after they get their pellet with 1200, 1500, 900. Their levels are high. They're high after they get the pellet, and then over the course of the months after the pellet, it goes down. But they get really high levels for a while. And women feel good when they get that first pellet and they get that surge of hormones, or hot flashes are better. Their libido is better. But the question is it safe? There's no data that that super physiologic dosing is safe. And if you want to talk about breast cancer risk or endometrial cancer risk or clotting risk, and what are we really doing with dosing that that's high? There's no reason we should be giving women doses that high, right? And so for all of those reasons, and the biggest reason is the North American Menopause Society, the organization that, you know, I'm involved with and believe in so strongly, we have guidelines. Our hormone position statement really is very clear that we do not support pellets, again, for all of these reasons. Patients, it's not manufacturing's not regulated. You don't get the package insert, so you're not well informed. And the dosing is just completely off. And so my mission is to educate women, again, just to ask a lot of questions if they're going to do this. And I understand why people get to the hormone centers and do this. And this goes back to the business of medicine side, right? There's no money in sitting and talking to a woman about the Women's Health Initiative data and the pros and cons of hormone therapy. There's no money in that, okay? There is money in giving pellets and charging for laboratory testing and all of that. So suddenly you can make menopause into a profitable business. And that's really part of it, right? That's, it's, again, I'm doing concierge medicine to make it work, right? Which is the same thing. How do you make women's health and primary care a sustainable business? That's kind of what's happening in the pellet centers too. And the other piece, which is not your fault, is that because we haven't educated primary care doctors. So all the time I have patients who say, well, I went to my primary care doctor who told me that hormones were bad. I saw my gynecologist who also told me hormones were bad, and I was miserable. And I had all my friends who said they went to this hormone center and they felt better. And so I went to the hormone center and I felt better. And I get that. I totally understand that. But again, this goes back to my mission with Ms. Medicine, which is I want to bring it back. I want to educate doctors so we can give women better care that's supported by data and guidelines. And I want to empower women to make sure they're getting good care, because I don't want women to get bad care, dangerous care, bad care, the wrong care, no care. The hope is to help the patient. We are all trying to help patients, right? And so I don't, it's not nefarious. It's just, again, not lack of information about really what the guidelines say and being nervous about doing hormones themselves.
Right. Yeah. And I definitely am rethinking this because I'm supposed to go
back. Luckily, you've only done it once.
You're
not harmed by that, right? So I don't want you to worry about that.
So I would absolutely love if you would come back at a different time and we could talk about breast cancer risks.
I would love to do that. So I am a breast cancer survivor, right? So I now say, and I lecture all the time, right, that I am living my own patient population. So I am now a 57-year-old old with chemotherapy-induced menopause who has ongoing terrible hot flashes because of the medication that I'm on. I have sexual dysfunction. I am a cancer survivor. I have osteoporosis. I have hair loss associated with menopause, right? So like I am living all of the things that my patients come in to talk to me about, right? And I have my journey has been always in the menopause and the sexual medicine space. My passion for breast cancer prevention has just dramatically escalated, obviously, since my own diagnosis, and my passion for really trying to improve cancer survivorship care, which, again, is just, I mean, we are just doing a terrible job. There's just not enough people who know anything about doing cancer survivorship at all, right? Mm-hmm. It's just there's not enough of us. And I would tell you, part through NAMS and through other professional organizations, I have colleagues that I should connect you with some of them to interview some of them, because we are not getting the message out enough about prevention of breast cancer, right? 30% of breast cancers in the United States could be prevented with lifestyle. Do you know that? Does anyone know
that? I didn't know that. No,
no, no. 30%. Okay. So I want you to think about the numbers, right? So 250,000 cases of breast cancer per year, 40,000 breast cancer deaths per year, 30% of those 250,000, about 70,000 cases of breast cancer a year in the United States could be prevented with lifestyle. And what is lifestyle?
Wow.
It's plant-based diet, less alcohol, maintaining ideal body weight, and exercise. And we never talk to women about lowering breast cancer risk and those things. We talk about lowering heart disease risk with lifestyle. We never talk about breast cancer risk. Women do not know the association. They do not know the association. So we're missing all of that. Women also don't know their breast density. They also, no one is taking enough of a family history, and we are missing all of these women with breast cancer. So many, I cannot even tell you. It's like 25% who carry a genetic mutation that puts them at high risk that don't know. I mean, we're just, we're doing such a bad job. There is so much room to do better, and we have to empower women to ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I never thought about asking about my breast density until, well, Colleen said she was told she had very dense breasts.
Dense breasts.
You will get it in your mammogram report, but the problem is, like when I lecture, about 25% of women now know something about breast density or that they should look. But the problem is, when you get your mammogram letter, you're just happy it's negative.
Right.
Like, you don't know what to do with any of the information on there. It says your breasts are dense or they're not dense, or like, what do you do with that? It's like telling you have blue eyes or you have brown eyes. Like, what do you do with that information? It doesn't do anything, right? But that's where, you know, there's models out there, right? Which nobody knows. I know that you haven't had it done, right? Someone's sitting down with you and literally going through and asking you a bunch of questions. And I can literally estimate your 5, 10, and lifetime year risk of developing breast cancer. And your breast density is a big part of that, in addition to your family history and your reproductive factors and your biometrics and all this kind of stuff that we have to put in. But it's time consuming to do that. But the information for a patient, it's like knowing your cholesterol is high or your coronary calcium score is abnormal. If you know those things, you're like, gosh, I need to pay attention to that. I should do something about that, right? If you knew your breast cancer risk was higher than population risk, if you knew that there were things you could change with your diet and exercise and lifestyle, you would do those things. The problem is, we're not telling women what their breast cancer risk is at all. All we're doing is telling them to get a mammogram. And the problem is, mammograms are looking for cancer that's already there. Like, that's like getting a stress test, just waiting to get your stress test to tell you that you have heart disease. Like, we really should be preventing heart disease. We should be preventing breast cancer, and nobody's approaching it that way yet.
That goes into the whole preventative care aspect, which is sadly lacking, but it is sadly lacking in healthcare. So I agree with you.
Primary care providers are seeing 26 patients a day, and I can tell you we have sick patients, and we can barely take care of their diabetes and their hypertension. Never mind. You think we're going to talk about the impact of soda on breast cancer risk, or animal protein on breast cancer risk, or the benefits of intermittent fasting, or, you know, I mean, there's so much data out there that is not translated into the space for women to understand.
Well, again, I would say, would you be willing to come back
and come back? Yeah.
Because we could do a whole episode just on, you know, educating women on breast cancer risks. It's really true. And I think it's going to take doctors and patients like Leslie, who started My Density. I think it's My Density Matters.
Bright Pink, Be Bright Pink is the other one that's
But it's going to take highlighting these organizations and doctors who are educated and getting the word out to women. And we would love to do that if you would come back.
Yes.
We'd love to come back. And I have a colleague who I would tell you should bring her on to, either with me or with someone else.
Be great. The fact that you came on and shared so much information in a short period of time, we just want to make sure we get some more of it. But we want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for all this information. Dr. Larkin, we are so glad you agreed to come back on, because there is so much left to talk about. And everything you said just was so thought-provoking that it led us to another question and another question. And you have the answers. And how often do you get to sit in a room or on Zoom with someone who can actually answer your questions? So not only has Bridget now felt confident that she's going to throw those pellets right out the window.
But if I could, there's probably a little part of them will stay with me, but I don't know if the actual hormone will, you know.
Yeah, she said that one shot.
One's probably not going to be as bad, but so I just am thankful for that warning. But like you said, I felt like I had a whole nother doctor's appointment, you know, a great conversational doctor's appointment that didn't really, because she couldn't see us, you know, you and I didn't know her whole background, but really ran the gamut of just telling you what you need to look for in your health. I was like, that's what I felt like. I just had this really great.
And that's why we asked her to come back on, because
that's right. You know,
breast cancer risk is such an important topic. We didn't get to it. We were like,
right,
can you come back? But you know, these conversations matter. And that's why we want to make sure that you are subscribing to Hot Flashes and Cool Topics, because we love bringing experts on who can talk to women about our health. It is so important. And we rarely discuss it. We put ourselves last on the list of things to do. And that needs to change. And it's only going to change by educating ourselves as to what our risk factors are. Like, your cardiovascular risk increases with menopause. Did most women know that? No.
No. You know, just with that, the family history involved, that whole test she talked about, the coronary calcium test. I'm like, what? I'd never heard of it.
And I highly suggest people check it out. Like I said, it cost $75 here. It was $100 where she is in Ohio. So it's worth it, honestly, to find out how high your risk is. Especially if you have a family history or you've had any mild symptoms, because again, search women's symptoms for heart attacks. It's so different than what the symptoms are for men. So please be aware of all these issues. And we are going to keep talking about them until you get sick of us talking about them. And then we'll talk about them some more. Guys, make sure to follow us on all social media, as we always ask you to do, because we appreciate that. And we add information there. We're always promoting the episodes and sharing information and topics, and also connecting with other women in midlife so that we're stronger together. And I just want to thank Dr. Larkin again, because it was a wonderful episode.
It was. Yes.
Have a great week, and we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.